Welcome to the Air Force Agency in Focus, sponsored by Leidos.
Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Eric White. The Coast Guard isn't the only military organization that rescues people domestically. The Air Force Rescue Coordination Center helps out people inland, including Mexico and Canada. It's based out of Tyndall Air Force Base in Florida. To hear some recent rescue stories, the center's commander, Lieutenant Colonel Gene Manner, spoke with Federal News Network's Tom Temin.
I don't think too many people are aware of the Air Force Rescue Coordination Center. What is it and what does it do? Let's start with the big picture here.
So we've been around since 1974, but the Air Force Rescue Coordination Center, the RCC is an internationally recognized term. And what we do is we provide kind of federal support to civil authorities when they've run out of the capability or means to execute search and rescue. They can coordinate either to the state or directly to us, sometimes depending on the agreement at hand. And we can provide federal search and rescue services in order to help save people's lives.
And I understand that Northern Command has some sort of state and local duty when called on by governors and so forth. Is it any way connected to that?
So the NORTHCOM commander in the National Search and Rescue Plan is designated as the federal search and rescue coordinator for the Inland 48 and for Alaska. Alaska has its own rescue coordination center, and it's called the Alaska Rescue Coordination Center. We're the Air Force Rescue Coordination Center. We coordinate for the lower 48. So that is his authority that he has been given, and we execute on that authority.
Got it. Okay. And what kind of assets do you have?
Actually, we have zero assets. What we do is we have a Rolodex of rescue assets, of DOD assets throughout the U.S. It's not Air Force specific. We use the Navy. We've used the Army. It's more of a capability-driven Rolodex that we have. So if a state needs a hoist capability, for example, they don't. Local sheriffs might not have a helicopter, and they need to do a hoist off of a mountainside. We'll call a local asset. It could be guard, it could be active duty, it could be reserve, and see if they can help to facilitate that search and or rescue.
So
we actually have no assets that are tagged to us.
Got it. So you don't have planes and helicopters and so forth. And I guess my question is, what about satellite imagery or satellite search and coordination or satellite communications? Can you provide that?
A lot of the work that we do is through 406 beacons, and what that uses a SAR satellite system. It's called SARSAT. And what that does is if someone has, so an ELT, an electron that's on an aircraft, if that goes off, we'll get a hit through in about 3 to 5 minutes, and that's at the longest time, of that information. So that satellite system, maybe not imagery, but of location, coordinates, it really helps to know kind of where ground zero is for that specific incident that might be happening. And so that's the satellite system that we tap into. And where we get a lot of our information for most of our rescues and our saves.
And who do the calls mostly come from? Is it local sheriffs and law enforcement or first responders at the county level, state level, city level?
So for each state, we have an MOA and an MOU, so a memorandum of agreement and a memorandum of understanding of how we would execute civil SAR. It's very different than when a hurricane comes through. So with those agreements, in each state's a little bit different. Usually the state has a state SAR coordinator, and SAR is search and rescue. And sometimes if a local county sheriff doesn't have the means to do it, they'll call the state. If the state can't help to coordinate within their own boundaries, so within a state, they have the jurisdiction to execute search and rescue.
There's a hierarchy.
There's a little bit of a hierarchy because we can bring a lot of assets to the fight. And the fight is kind of the wrong word, stateside. We actually get to execute the mission. Instead of training in a wartime environment, we are executing the mission on a daily basis. So that hierarchy is a little bit important because we can't be the first one to call, but we're that kind of break glass function when they have no other means to execute a search and rescue, please call us. And that's where we kind of jump in and help connect some of the dots. So again, since we don't have assets, we provide, we ask units. We can't task anybody. I can't tell someone to go do it. But we can ask units, and they really, really, I've never had someone say no because it's real world training, and they know that is going to help someone's life right now.
We're speaking with Lieutenant Colonel Gene Manner, commander of the Air Force Rescue Coordination Center at Tyndall Air Force Base. That must be pretty exciting if you're stranded and the U.S. Air Force comes and picks you up. But what kinds of assets are, you said helicopters, what else might be available on their agreement from the Air Force? And is it the regular Air Force or is it reserves?
It's anybody, and it's not just Air Force. The Air Force Rescue Coordination Center kind of has a misleading name. We're really an aeronautical rescue coordination center. So we've used the naval helicopters out of Whidbey Island. They do a lot of great work for us. There's a HATSA high altitude helicopter team that's in Colorado. Those are Army. Some of them are Guard, some of them are Air Force, some of them are the Guard, active duty, and reservists. And so it's a breadth of assets. Civil Air Patrol actually we use them quite a bit, and the capabilities that they bring to the fight, they all volunteer force. And two of the teams that we actually use quite a bit, they have a cell forensics team and a radar forensics team that really help when a local sheriff calls or a local search and rescue. We call them incident commanders, whoever that is in the state executing that search and rescue. And that helps them narrow down a huge search area to a very small, like, starting point. Hey, start here. This is the last point where this cell phone was pinging, or this aircraft, this is the last spot we have it on radar. And they get, they're within a mile or two usually, and that narrows down that search area quite a bit. So Civil Air Patrol does fantastic things for us that most people don't know about.
And any good recent rescue stories, and how did that all work?
So we have a couple big ones that we've had lately. Usually search and rescues that make national news, often we were involved in some form or fashion. We're not the tip of the spear picking someone on a helicopter, but helping to coordinate that is still very much an important thing. We had a long-range rescue. We work with our sister services, as you mentioned earlier, and with Mexico and Canada and anywhere around the world if we really needed to. But the Coast Guard called us about 2 weeks ago, and they had a Mexican fishing vessel. Fishermen had been injured, two of them quite severely, one with a broken skull or a fractured skull, and the other one had a crushed leg from a crane that had collapsed on their boat. Of course, being 1,200 miles off of Cabo in Mexico, it's tough for any assets to get out there. A couple of days for a Coast Guard cutter to get out there. So they reached out to us, and we were able to coordinate with some of our Air Force long-range rescue assets. There's a group out of Davis-Monthan called the 563rd Rescue Group. They have PJs, a pararescuemen, HC-130s, and HH-60s. And for this one, the HC-130s and the pararescuemen flew out almost 1,600 miles, did an airdrop, and dropped an 8-person team down to the fishing vessel and helped to stabilize and secure those patients until they were able to get to higher care at a Mexican naval facility about 2.5 days later. They were on the boat and sailed with them for a while. So those kind of incidents, those long-range ones, don't happen very often, but the skill set that the DOD brings, whatever service is there, help to save these two international fishermen's lives. So it's not just people that are doing every day that are in the lower 48, but anyone that really needs help. So we worked with the Coast Guard in that incident. And the other one was, I think it was about a week or so ago, there was a lady who went missing out in California. I think it was California. Her husband had dropped her off at the campsite, went to park his car.
Sure.
And then she was missing. And a couple of days later, able to ride some helo assets to help search the area, and even though the helo didn't find them, it gave that incident commander an added capability to further that search and provide some help to that family. And she was found, and it was fantastic. It's always great news when someone is found. So those are two kind of recent stories that we've done.
I guess in some odd way, when you help out Mexico and a Mexican fisherman who's far offshore, it's sort of good for international relations, too, especially when things are strained with Mexico.
It is. And I don't think that one made the news very much. And we're not here to brag about what we do. We just want to help save people's lives. And so incidents like that, partially because, and good or bad, when someone goes missing, usually people are posting and calling 911. Well, the Mexican fishermen really only had one person to call, and that came in the form of the Coast Guard, and they coordinated with us. So there wasn't live media and social media going on, and we're okay with that. And, our job isn't here to show that, hey, we're the AFRCC. Our job is to help save people's lives. And So last year, for example, in 2018, people probably don't know how busy we are. We ran over 10,000 incidents. We executed almost 933 missions, and we saved 550 lives.
Lieutenant Colonel Gene Manner is commander of the Air Force Rescue Coordination Center at Tyndall Air Force Base, speaking with Federal News Network's Tom Temin. Time for a quick break. When we come back, whatever form a new Space Force takes, success will require the right culture. I'm Eric White.
Artificial intelligence is often portrayed as a magic wand that will solve everything. But in reality, unlocking the power of AI comes from looking beyond the hype and focusing on thoughtful and realistic problem solving. At Leidos, we're focused on helping our customers adopt AI and machine learning tools with solutions that solve real problems. With a deep understanding of our customers, we're creating reliable, resilient, and secure solutions that look beyond the hype. Learn more at Leidos.com/AI.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Eric White. Space Force, Space Command, Department of Space. It's not certain what form the military space assets will take. A former Air Force nuclear and space operations officer argues that some type of separate Space Force could do good if it has the right culture. Brian Whedon is the director of program planning at the Secure World Foundation. He tells Federal News Network's Tom Temin just what that means.
When the announcement was first made by President Trump calling for a separate part of the Space Force, I was one of its more vocal public critics, not because there wasn't a problem. I think there's a lot of problems the way the Air Force currently handles a lot of the military base activities, but that I wasn't sure that that sort of big solution, creating an entirely new department in the U.S. government, really fit the problem. Because what this is really about is how best do we organize military space activities in the U.S. For much of the last 20 years, the U.S. Air Force has mainly been the entity running military space activities, but they've run into a lot of challenges recently. And there's a growing number of people, including me, and many in Congress, who are frustrated about some of the shortcomings. So that is what's prompted this whole debate. And creating a separate department of the Space Force, as President Trump called for, is one potential answer. But there are other answers as well. About how you restructure that. So a lot of this debate has focused on that structural question.
And I guess maybe the underlying assumption behind all of this is that space is growing in importance as a domain, even though it's always been important to communications. But there's a lot of change in space technology happening itself, and there's more dependence on it ahead for the military?
Absolutely. Since the 1950s, the U.S. has relied heavily on space for national security, primarily intelligence collection and satellites to count Soviet missiles and troop deployments, and a little bit later on doing arms control. What we've seen over the last couple of decades is space has become an integral part of military operations, conventional warfighting, and pretty much national security as a whole. It's hard to think of a military operation today the U.S. conducts that doesn't involve or depend on space to a significant degree. So that's the real challenge, is as people look to the future, if future conflicts are going to involve space, and if those future conflicts involve what Trump should call a great power competitor like Russia or China that is developing anti-satellite and counter-space capabilities, then the U.S. is going to have to figure out how to deal with those threats to its space capabilities and how to maintain its own access to space in those future conflicts. That is one of the big challenges facing the space community.
Former Air Force Space Officer Brian Whedon is Director of Program Planning at the Secure World Foundation. We'll have the rest of his interview after a quick break. I'm Eric White.
Artificial intelligence is often portrayed as a magic wand that will solve everything. But in reality, unlocking the power of AI comes from looking beyond the hype and focusing on thoughtful and realistic problem solving. At Leidos, we're focused on helping our customers adopt AI and machine learning tools with solutions that solve real problems. With a deep understanding of our customers, we're creating reliable, resilient, and secure solutions that look beyond the hype.
Learn more at Leidos.com/AI.
We now continue our interview with Brian Whedon, former Air Force Space Officer and Director of Program Planning at the Secure World Foundation.
And is one of the challenges here in organizing this in some different way, the fact that, yes, even though the services are stovepiped, they all use space, they might be separate at the budget level, but at the operational level and in the commands around the world, around the globe that they operate, they do have a lot of intertwined plumbing.
Absolutely, they do. And that's another piece of this that often gets missed, is there are actually two different organizational structures in the U.S. military. There's one structure that is aimed at what they call the operate, train, equip function. That is, they recruit people to come in, they train those people to do certain missions and tasks, and they buy and acquire hardware and capabilities that can be used. That's what the services do. That's what the Air Force does. It's what the Army does, the Navy, what the Marine Corps does. There's a whole separate organizational structure called combatant commands, whose job is to take all those capabilities the services create and use them to go fight wars and conduct military operations. So, for example, Central Command has authority over the parts of the world that include both Iraq and Afghanistan, and sort of has been a very important combatant command, kind of running those wars and managed activities. Indo-Pacific Command is also in there, with European Command, Africa Command, Southern Command, Northern Command. So these are all kind of the people, the parts of the military actually, you know, do war fighting. So part of this debate is not only how do we reorganize the operate, train, equip piece of space, but also how do we reorganize the warfighting piece of space, and how does that integrate into all these other capabilities, you know, ships and tanks and planes and infantry troops, and how do all of those kind of come together into a coherent set of capabilities? So on the OT&E side, this is what the Space Force would do, in that the proposal was to take the operate, train, equip functions for space away from the Air Force and give them to a different entity, whether it's a Space Force or a Space Corps. And on the flip side, to pull the space warfighting responsibilities away from U.S. Strategic Command and give them back to U.S. Space Command, which was deactivated back in the early 2000s.
And all of that leads to the question of, yes, there's a lot of complications and it's easy to move around organizational boxes, but your thesis, which you have expressed in Task and Purpose, says that the culture of whatever organization they stand up might be more important, or at least as important, as the organizational structure. What do you mean by culture, and how should it be?
Yes, and that's an extremely important point that I think has been missed in this whole debate. Organizations have a culture. What do I mean by that? Organizations have priorities, they have interests, they have set ways of doing things and processes, and those, that culture and those interests and processes actually have huge impacts on what organizations do and how they behave. And so one of the big criticisms of the current arrangement is that the U.S. Air Force has a culture built around aircraft and airplanes and air dominance, and that is not well suited to creating, you know, space professionals that know and understand the space domain, which is very different from the air domain. So when you're thinking about how we're going to do this change and change up these organizational structures, the big question in my mind is, what kind of a culture is the Space Force or the Space Corps, whatever we end up calling it, going to have? And I think getting that right is going to be really critical to its success. I'm argued in my article that, you know, the Space Force that we create should have a service-oriented culture that is more akin to an air mobility command than sort of a strict warfighting culture that a air combatant command would have. And why is that? Well, you know, we're certainly going to have to deal with threats to U.S. satellites, and also, you know, be able to take steps to deal with other countries like Russia and China's use of their own space capabilities. But the primary focus is still going to be how those space capabilities enable and benefit U.S. military activities on Earth.
And
so that is more of a service-orientated mission, like tankers and airlift and other sorts of things, that is absolutely critical to mission operations. But it's a different mindset than, you know, going out and looking to, you know, blow things
sure.
up and break things. That's more of the warfighting culture.
And when you mentioned service, that leads to the idea also that it has to be, on the acquisition end of things, basically a buyer of services as opposed to hardware, because most of the satellite services that are used in the military are actually acquired from commercial capabilities. And the expansion that's expected of commercial capabilities with the launch of promised hundreds and hundreds of low orbit communications type satellites, which could have benefit to the military. So the acquisition end of this whole thing is going to have to be oriented toward buying services.
Yes. And you use the word services or capabilities. And that's exactly right. You know, again, going back to the culture, the current space acquisitions culture in the Air Force is one that dates back from the Cold War, when you said, basically, we need to have a capability to do X. That means we're going to stand up a huge program that's going to stretch 10, 20 years. We're going to spend billions of dollars to build a few extremely capable satellites, but they're also only a few of them, and they're very expensive. They're going to take very long to build. And then we're going to stand up thousands of people or hundreds of people to dedicated solely to managing and operating those satellites. That's sort of the old way the military does space activities and space acquisitions, and that just doesn't cut it. You know, today the pace of change is moving so much faster. There's so many more options. Instead of the Air Force owning and operating its own hardware, they could purchase a commercial service. They could work with, you know, allies and partners to get access to capabilities. You know, there are many other options out there. So that is a big part of this, is fixing that acquisitions culture to allow the U.S. military to move faster, to stay ahead of potential competitors.
Former Air Force Space Officer Brian Whedon is Director of Program Planning at the Secure World Foundation. We'll post this entire episode online if you missed any of it at federalnewsnetwork.com. Search Agency in Focus. I'm Eric White.
Thank you for listening to the Air Force Agency in Focus, sponsored by Leidos on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network.